When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm afraid I've had, throughout my life, I've had a very bad habit of talking too long. How my audiences remained listening for the length of time that I spoke, I often wonder now. On one occasion, I gave a talk on the Holy Land. I'd been to the Holy Land, and I thought that these people whom I was speaking would like to listen to it. An old man's home. And one of the old men was coming on to 10 o'clock at night, and I think he wanted to get free in any case. But he was asked, he had been asked deputed to propose a vote of thanks to me. So he began the vote of thanks in this way. We have had a most exhaustive, and indeed, if I might add, a most exhausting lecture.
And indeed, the very first time that I heard that voice face to face, so to speak, he talked for some 2 hours, Eamon de Valera did, President de Valera then, 2 hours with no recordings, and I lived in the Valley of the Damned broadcasters for that few hours. I had insinuated myself into a private visit of Dev's down to Brewery, and I was in the home of Monaghan Shoey in Tankerstown when he arrived with his entourage late in the afternoon. I said, "Mr. President, I would like to do a series about your boyhood." And he was firm but pleasantly reluctant. And there was a certain softening, I thought. But then when I rushed for tape recorder, he said, "No, this cannot be recorded." And he talked, as I say, he talked on and on, talked about childhood, Brewery, and about the neighbours. Finally, Maureen Keller thought of a compromise and said, "Why wouldn't you record some of the President's old school friends?" And I could see the President felt that perhaps there was a way out from this young man who would not let go. So I said, "Certainly, we'll do that." I got the list of names, and within a week, I was back onto the Áras in all my innocence on the phone and saying, "Auchtarán, Tad Nadine Shaw Gomanish." Reluctantly, I think he said, "Well, we'd better make it next Tuesday." So Paddy O'Donovan and myself, mobile unit and all, girded our loins, wore our best suits and headed for the Áras on a frosty morning in the month of November 1965. We met him at the door and he was quiet, he was monosyllabic, and I think I'd almost say he was as nervous as we were ourselves. We came into this big room and there was the big table, and I was sat at one corner and Dev sat behind, and this large, what they call, I think, a ball and biscuit microphone sat on the table in front of him, and it was monosyllabic for a long time. And then, after 2 hours or so, he said, "Well, the next time you come, I'll be much better." But that was 2 hours after his beginning. His beginnings, I suppose, of dipping deep down into the deep well of De Valera memory. A memory, I suppose, which, like all our memories, is not always certain, especially if you're spanning something like 80 years and going back, indeed, to 1885, to your very first night in Ireland.
I don't remember it, of course, but my first view of that neighbourhood must have been from the hill of Knockmore. My first night, curiously enough, was, I think, the last that anybody stepped in what we call the old house. The old house was a thatched house. The walls were of mud or clay, and they were fairly substantial too. I remember using a pickaxe in later years and a crowbar to try and break them up, and there'd be about nearly 3 feet at the base. They were very substantial. But my first night, anyhow, was in that old house, and I wakened up in the morning, and there was nobody about. And I suppose I was frightened, and I shouted and screamed. At any rate, my aunt, who would be, I suppose, about 15 years of age or so at the time, she came in to to soothe me, and I asked her where my uncle was, where Uncle Ed was, and she told me he was up at the new house. So that I was wondering what the, I remember wondering what the new house could be. So they apparently it was a cottage. They had been just moving from the old house, the old thatched house, to a labourer's cottage. It was one of the first cottages built in Ireland. I think it was about the second in the Kilmallock Union, and to be about the fourth in Ireland as a whole. I think there were, I was told when I was young, I was told that there were a couple of houses built in Louth, I think it was, before these were built. However, the family were moving just at the time, and the men probably had been sleeping that the night that I was sleeping in the old house. They had been sleeping in the new house, in the cottage. My grandmother and aunt probably slept in the old house with me. But I remember it well, and I was always interested in the fact that my first night in Ireland was the last night that anybody slept in the old house.
Memories now flowed fast, free and warm, and inevitably, of course, there was Brewery.
When my grandmother took me to Brewery to see the boycott meeting, I was in petticoats, I remember well, and I had long hair. My grandmother was rather proud, if I might put it like that. She was rather proud of my hair. It was of a golden colour, I believe, and she wanted me to keep on wearing it. My uncle, on the other hand, had more regard for my feelings in the matter with other boys, and he wanted to cut it off. So he, on one occasion, he did cut it off. I cut it off, and my grandmother was very, very angry. I remember before it was cut off that I must have been rather fat at the time, and we had a little straw Irish terrier named Jess, and she had the habit of putting her paws up to my breast and throwing me over. And when she had me down, then she catched me by the hair and tried to pull me along. I seemed to enjoy it, but my uncle didn't like the long hair at all, and he was determined that he was going to put an end to it.
And if you enter Áras de Valera nowadays in Brewery, which is the museum, you can see a lock of that same golden hair of young Eddie de Valera in that schoolroom where he first learned his very, very first lessons.
Oh, I remember the schoolroom very well. It unfortunately has been divided since. It was a fine room as it was. And there would be about 60 pupils. One half would be, as a rule, standing up, and the other half would be sitting down the desks. Those who in the desks would be practicing writing, or doing some arithmetical exercises, or something of that sort, perhaps learning grammar or something. And those who would be standing were being questioned by the teachers and being taught directly by the teachers. I remember well when the weather was in the winter time, on one occasion anyhow, we had each to bring a shilling to buy coal, so that because the room was very, very cold. And that time I think a shilling would buy about 100 weight of coal, so that if one half the school brought it, it would bring us through the winter.
Some time ago you mentioned your geography game.
Oh, yes. That was a game we had with those of us who we got in early in the morning before the master came. He had to travel. This was the time probably when he had to travel from Killicollor. And we'd, if we were in the morning, half an hour, a quarter of an hour before the master came, we'd stand round in front of a map of the world and try to puzzle each other by asking such strange names. Can you, where's Kamchatka? Point out Kamchatka. Point out Christmas Island, and so on.
Two brothers of mine in the same class at him, I was speaking to him there some time ago, and he mentioned them. And on one occasion, he jokingly told me that they had a battle around the schoolyard, and that my brother knocked against him, ran over him, and he happened to have a loose tip in his boot, and he cut a scar in his hand, and it had to be stitched.
So the president bears the mark of one of the O'Keefe boys.
There's the mark. Show it to me. That's last August.
There was a slight slope in the schoolyard. In my time, I don't know if they have leveled it. I don't think they have. There was a slight slope. To me, it looked a big slope in my day. It went up towards Roach's Quarry. The top end of it was, the wall was joining Roach's Quarry. And we used to sometimes get ghost downs. Now, a ghost down, if you pull it up, there's a good hefty root, which yeah. you see. Mm. So, evidently, we used to have with the those went down Hurlstone Way at the cross of the pump. We were in one batch against the those went over towards Joyce's country. That's Bulgadon and not Bulgadon, but Tankerstown, in the Tankerstown direction, and. We arranged to have a fight anyhow in the schoolyard this day when we were out for lunchtime. And we all armed ourselves in Roach's Field, the quarry field. We armed ourselves with Gosodons. So there was I was in the lower end, defending up against the height with the lower boys. I wasn't by any means a leader, but I was one of them. And we were facing up. The others were facing down the hill, so there was a charge, anyhow. And in the charge, I was thrown back, and the fellow put his a broken tip of a shoe. He put it there, and I had the mark.
The mark now.
The mark now. It's one of the things that I've had.
Proof in presidential flesh of the Laurence O'Keefe story. Interesting too, how the County Limerick accent remains to the very end. Interesting too, how my own accent of voice seems to have changed since those days in 1965. Dave, now and again, would forget, of course, that I knew precisely where he came from. I was only across the border in Charleville, so words that he had, so would I have had also.
There was a word you wouldn't understand, I think. Leeching and slinging. Mm-hmm. These were two words that used to be the word if you were... what's just the regular word for mitching? Mm-hmm. The regular word. But we used to have leeching. Why, I don't know. Leeching and slinging. Mm-hmm. These were the two words that would be used if you were away from school. But he wasn't in this particular day, so the master asked me, or it might be the monitor was in charge, and he asked me, would I go over and bring in Dick Hull? So I had a day, it was an afternoon off for me, or a portion of time off for me, so I suppose like most kids, I was delighted to get away from the books and went off to bring in Dick. So I went in to call Foxy Pat's. He was the son of Foxy Pat. I went to Foxy Pat's house and I asked, was Dick about? And I met, the first man I met was this man from, I met him afterwards. Next time I met him was, I mean, when I met him later in life, he was receiving me at Nina on my way down to Clare for the Clare election. But we used to call him, he used to sell tea. They had he had a trap, I think it was Foxy Pat's business anyhow. He had tea, used to take around tea and sell it to the various people, you see. So he had a very good voice and he used to sing. And one of the first songs that first I met him was Break the Bank, do you see, Monte Carlo. So they christened him Monte Carlo because he used to sing this song. He'd be driving along and he'd be singing Monte Carlo. So they called him Monte Carlo. Monte Carlo met me when I was in. He said, who do you want? I said, I want Dick. Well, I think he's in here in the barn. He said, yeah, something. So he got me into the barn. And he locked me in. Into the barn. I have an idea that I got out a window, but I'm not sure of that, that I climbed up to a window and got out, but I'm not sure of that. But that was my first imprisonment. He used to always boast he was my first jailer.
Dev seemed to remember everything, even his first photograph.
Oh, I remember it well. I think it was when my aunt was about to go to America. And they were anxious, probably, to send my photograph to my mother. So I had a grand journey to Limerick by train. It was my first journey on the train. And, of course, I was being dolled up before I started out. And one of the troubles was the boots. The boots apparently didn't pass muster. And a solution was found. I found that my aunt's boots, which were button boots, would fit me. At least I thought they'd fit me. I didn't think so, because I didn't like the idea at all. I preferred the old boots. However, they put on the button boots of my aunt, and I was taken to O'Shea's of Limerick. And I remember seeing the man behind the curtain, behind the cover that he put over his head when he was taking the photograph. And he was trying to attract my attention so that I'd look straight at him. But I have a copy of the photograph still.
Well, I remember him coming home from college when I was about 4 years of age. He was very, very tall, wearing black clothes, and with big brown eyes.
Was he a quiet chap?
Very quiet, very good and very gentle and very helpful in the house, and very nice to us children, my brother and myself.
Did you tell me a while ago that he taught you to play football?
Well, I suppose we were 8 or 9. He brought a football to my brother, and he took the two of us into the field, and he showed us how to play it. And of course, he gave it a big kick across the field, and then another one up into the air, and I thought it would never again come down. So then, of course, our attempts at football were very, very feeble.
Dev's first cousin, Mrs. Henry Maher, in the old homestead in Knockmore. From the field of Knockmore to the field of politics in those days in Bruree was no journey at all.
As far as my political recollection is concerned, my uncle used to read the paper for my grandmother, and I was sleeping in the room in the loft upstairs, and I could hear whatever went on in the kitchen. So my uncle used to read from papers the news, and I listened in as a rule if I were awake. So I remember my first recollection, I think, was the shooting at Mitchelstown, and the horror was expressed by my aunt, my grandmother, you know, at this terrible business. And then after that, the next recollection I think I have would probably be about the time that William O'Brien escaped from Tullamore Jail. And Mandeville, I think, was with him at the time. There, I'm not sure was he with him, but he was let go from prison after a time. He was released, and he died. These are the earliest, I think. Perhaps there was an early one. I'm not quite sure would it be earlier. I was taken by my grandmother. It was on a Sunday. At a mass, I was taken to an eviction meeting. There was a boycotting meeting of John Gubbins. Father Sheehy, I think it was, who led the boycott.
Indeed, the importance of that same Father Sheehy could not be overstressed in Dev's case, because he told me that in early January each year on the Feast of St. Munchen, he would preach a special sermon in Bruree Church, telling them that they came of a kingly race, and of course describing the place, Bruree, Brunery, whichever you like, and as Dev would say himself, he enthused him. But while there were enthusiasms, there was also the future to think of. There was work, career, business, as I say, the future.
I know that my grandmother had hoped that she might be able to apprentice me to be a carpenter. I would have liked that all right. But fundamentally, I think my desire was to become a priest. I'm not sure that I had any very definite ideas about it, however.
Oh, he was clever the whole time, and he was always Judas, you know. He was. And then there was a fellow up in Garus. No, he told me his name now, and he got a good pastor, a good examination in Charleroi, and he thought he might as well do it or try to do it. So he did it and he got it. But he used to be very tired, you know, when he'd come home from school in the evening.
I'm sure he must
have. He used to get up in the morning there, now where you saw, at, well, I'd say 6:30. I think the first train was up at 7 or 8. Now I forget, was it 7 or 8, the train. And then there was 2 miles walk into the school.
From the station.
From the station in Charleroi into the school. And he used to walk the 6 miles home in the evening. It was more than 6 to 7, I suppose, from the school in Charleroi to the cottage.
I went by train in the morning. We had to get up very early. The train left Brewery about 8:20 in the morning. I was supposed to reach Charleroi station about 8:00, and then I walked in 1.5 miles from the station into the school. I suppose I got into the school about roughly before 9:00. Mm. And I utilised any time I had in the train to, that was the only time I had really to make up any home lessons.
Yes.
Except on the weekend.
Were the trains very comfortable that time?
Oh, I didn't bother about comfort at that time. Looking back, I know that there were no cushions on the seats. We were travelling third class. But that didn't bother me. What interested me most was our own station in Brewery. It was a favourite playground of mine. With some of the other boys, we used to go up to Sutton's store. When the wagons were emptied of the coal, they were allowed to slide down to the buffers on a slope, and we used to always be anxious to get a jaunt on them. On these occasions, we could cling on to the side of the bus or the truck, and stand on the brake when we wanted to bring it to a halt.
I was in Charleroi 2 years before that, and then I went to St. Munchan's College in Limerick, and directly I left, he came to go there. And he told somebody, he told it to more than one. I got the exhibitions in Charleroi and things like that, and he said, that's what made me go there. Paddy Shea, that was me, got exhibitions and money prizes there and all this kind of thing. And only for that, he says, I never might have gone there and I'd be still hunting the cows.
Oh, that was one of my principal tasks. Of course, I had very often to feed the cows too. I remember cutting buckets of turnips for them in the evening and cutting some hay off the bench with a hay knife and giving them, as we'd say, a wall of hay. And looking after them generally. My uncle, of course, had principal care of them. But there was only a half acre attached to the cottage. That was before the 10.5 acres was given, which was several years later. In my time, there was only a half an acre. It wasn't sufficient to feed the cows, of course. We had 3 or 4 cows generally, and you had to get some pasture for them. The only available pasture was that on the roadsides. There were good broad edges that time between the road proper and the fences, and very good grass on them too. Of course, there was a good deal of the dust on the roads, but there wasn't such an amount of traffic. And one of my tasks was to take the cows out on the long farm, as we called the roadside, and look after them. I had to be particularly careful because you could be summoned at that time by the police for cattle being straying on the road. If anybody was with the cattle, you couldn't so easily be summoned because it would be much harder to prove that you weren't taking the cattle from one place to another. My sight was better than that of my uncle, And I generally had a lookout for the police. If they were on the north side of the house at all, which they generally were, I would be able to see the police coming along at the cross to the road to Drummond, across it's near Brewery Cross. We used to call it Farrell's Cross, I think. In my time, it was called Handren's Cross afterwards. But I remember I could easily distinguish two policemen. They always went out on their beat in pairs. I could distinguish them easily. If they were going in the evening, they generally took their carbines strapped over their shoulders with the bayonets by their sides. And they walked in such a way that it was obvious to me, anyhow, at the distance, which would be something about half a mile away or a little more, that it was that they were policemen and not two of the farmers or two of the laborers about. When I saw them, I went for the cows and took them off the road, which was their general beat that's around by Howardstown, took them onto the Clonbrian Road or down the Atlacky Road. I should have given the proper pronunciation, Atlacky Road.
Even if the young De Valera was on the Atlacky Road, as he says himself, things of the mind were not neglected.
I remember reading Robinson Crusoe, for instance. I remember reading that when I was minding the cows. Then later, I used to read books. I remember reading on Hill of Knockfinora. I remember reading in the Life of Napoleon by Abbott. It's a very full life, and he was an admirer of Napoleon's. And, it was written from a sympathetic point of view. It was very, very interesting, but a very big book. However, I think I managed to get through it on the side of the Hill of Knockfinora. The ones I remember best were, first of all, the big book, Abbey Gagan's History of Ireland, which my uncle used to read, from which my uncle used to read aloud time to time. Then from the Uncle Ramus, we had also the Scottish Chiefs, and I forget, oh yes, my mother had brought a copy of Moore's Melodies, which my uncle used to read. I can see him in imagination and recollection. I can see him now sitting on the table on a Sunday afternoon reading aloud the songs from the melodies. And Moore's Melodies, the Scottish Chiefs, Gagan's History. And then, as I say, in the Uncle Ramus Club, we got books like The Bog of Stars. And I don't know, was it from them we got Ivanhoe, which was one of the first long books that I remember reading when I was going to national school. And The Story of Ireland, of course.
One evening, and he was about 18, I think, they were footballing in the 40 acres. That was our field, and he came along. And I told him there was a letter in the post for him. It was a very important letter because he was after getting a big exam. So he came back to the post office and I gave him the letter. And he was overjoyed at it. So after that, we became very friendly and he used to come in. He used to be in and out of the post office a good deal, of course, hearing from his mother from America and all that sort of thing. He was taller than them all and he used to always... He had an awful strap of books, I remember that. And it's... up to the time he went to Charleville and when he came back then from Rockwell, because he used to be writing to his mother and hearing from the mother and used to be coming into the post office and we used sometimes have chats. And I remember one evening he passed through the village in what they call a Ginnetan car, not a ponying car now, the Uncle's. And there was a Miss McAuliffe, a teacher at the post office. And somebody said there was De Valera down his home from school. So she said, let me see him, she says. I'm tired of hearing of my nephews talking about this De Valera. He was teaching at the time and also studying at Rockwell.
Life and death are inseparable, always have been in the Irish countryside, then as now, and the young De Valera would have been well aware of this.
The funeral was late in the day, and I was herding with Tom Martin on the side of what we used to call Martin's Hill. It was a part of Knockmore. When we were tired, we sat down. I had been warned not to sit on wet grass, so I sat in the bus of the hurley, and we were both looking, I suppose, to be northwest. When I saw this funeral winding around from the house, cross over the railway bridge, the bridge across the railway at Howardstown. It was very distinct to me as it, the hearse and the other cars passed by. I saw it probably later when it was going over the... No, I saw it a second time when it was going over probably the bridge over the Mag at Howardstown too. However, it set me thinking death and life and the shortness of life and the hereafter. And that set me wondering about the world around me, whether it really existed or whether it was as it exists for us in a dream. And to satisfy myself anyhow, I pinched Tom Martel, who was beside me. The response I got left me no doubt as to the actuality of the world outside me. I remember that during the whole of my life may have been the reason why on one occasion when I was elected a lecture by a professor of metaphysics that he called me a crude realist. I wasn't, of course, a crude realist, but however, I had no doubt as to the reality of the world, the external world, and the response I got for the pinch.
Recording a boy from Brewery with Eamon De Valera in the 60s had something of a stream of consciousness effect about it. We hopped here, there and everywhere in our disparate paths, you could say. One day he asked me a leading question after talking about Parnell. He said, "Do you know teaching McFadden to dance?" I didn't, but I suppose as the clichés say, thereby hangs a tale.
They had a big dance which was called a ball. We had the principal player, the principal instrumentalist at the ball was a man named Flaherty, who played the pipes. He was noted for playing particularly the fox chase on the pipes. But I remember they paid, each person paid a shilling or something like that, and they got some refreshments during the night, and they had a really good time. There were quite a number of people who were very good dancers. McCarthy, that I mentioned already, was a good dancer. But we had one famous dancer, we used to call him Morris the Dusht. I suppose he used to dance on the road very often, and no doubt, and these days there was dust on the road. So I have no doubt that it was from the amount of dust that was knocked up when he was dancing a hornpipe or something like that, from that he got the name.
Did you ever learn to dance yourself, Ochtron?
I can't say that I learned very well. My grandmother sent me to get some lessons in dancing. There was a dancing master that went from place to place. And when he was in Brewery, my grandmother told me that I should go down and learn and get some lessons in dancing from him. I was taught the sidestep and taught the jig. And I was taught one or two of the set dances also. But I'm afraid I didn't practice dancing at all.
Ni rev dev gro wa her dawsa. Ah, no, ni ro reev. Ni donum, I huan a stole me keili fi round a man an, as you magler giri dev dollar inca. A durin che, cha fali limni, ag ni rev si gro wa. Vi si ro wa ar de stole lung taskan.
Legs too long for dancing, perhaps he had, but legs long enough to bestride a horse, if not like a colossus, at least like a jockey on the roads of County Limerick.
We were coming home from Charlburn, and about half a mile or so outside the town, This man came along on a horse, and he was obviously had taken too much drink because he was going from side to side. I knew the man well. He came from Tullaboy, and he had a famous horse, March Boy, and evidently he was riding. So the horse he was riding, it was a horse that had won the Child of a Plate. And he had great regard for this horse. But he was, I was afraid that he'd tumble off, get killed, because just at our house, a man had fallen from a horse and was unconscious for a very long time. So I was very anxious about him, but could do nothing. But then John Gubbins came along with his steward Armstrong shortly after, and he passed us by, and when he came, caught up on the horseman, he would be about a couple of hundred yards ahead of us. He stopped, and the steward came off and pulled the man off the horse, and this man was kicking very hard. He didn't want to be moved from his horse, you see. But Stuart was a big, strong man, and he got up on the car himself and put him sitting beside him on the sidecar. But then the horse was in question. What were they going to do with the horse? It was hard enough to keep this man quiet, but to bring the horse was another matter. So Gubbins saw us coming along, and he beckoned. And Les Gubbins, you know, who was the owner of the two horses that won the English Derby, Galtymore and Ard Patrick. And he beckoned to us to come along. I came up with the other boy, and then he said, "Can any of you fellows, can any of you ride a horse?" So I put up my hand, and I could. Mm-hmm. I had ridden a horse of the farmers round, good deed. And I had never been in a racehorse, I tell you before. So I got on the horse, and then we're going to trot after the car. He was driving along, trot after the car. But whenever I was near the car at all, the owner of the horse became obstreperous, and they had difficulty with him, so they begged me to go back. So then I turned, I was delighted, I turned on, I cantered back for half a mile, then cantered back the half a mile again until I came near them, and then cantered back again. So I had a great time.
The Golden Vale was and is, always has been, great horse country. It is too indeed great hurling country, and in those times people made their own hurlies.
Vi sem fælde hegut en snomane jægt, når jeg...
Ah, vi er ikke det buklige over. Og jeg skal nu komme, så er det en kommand, har vi virk pisse rejmet, og jeg kaster ikke en mund, ikke du? Og jeg virk i nødt lige råd, virk pisse rejmet, og jeg kan det en tænne med vi en borik.
Borik?
Borik. Sådan en tænne med vi er en gælden råd. Kuple ålder er redd, og hvis ålder kan lene om at sin træsne.
Vi har kjennet i akkurat er sin våle.
Er det vær? Ja, det er
vær.
Er det mor? 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 Er det sin? Ach, nye, kommer det stærk. Nu er det vi nødt til at komme ind, og
The young boys around Knockmore had certain, of course, less helpful avocations, as indeed we all had, but we used papers, but they were entirely different.
There's a certain cane, and it's very porous. Mm-hmm. And if you burn it, you can suck the smoke through it. So that was, we called it rattan. I don't know what is the real name for it. Never looked it up. But rattan is what we called it anyhow. A rattan cane. Did you ever hear?
No, I haven't heard that.
A rattan cane. And a small one, if these, a thin one of these, we'd use it. But turf was very common.
Smoking turf.
Smoke turf. And then when this chap, Martin, was he introduced me, I remember, to the looky bag.
Did you have a penny looky bag?
And in this looky bag, you'd get some, but one of the things you'd be hoping to get was a little pipe. Sometimes there was a little pipe, a very miniature pipe. But you'd put turf in it. Some people I've heard afterwards, they used, when I'd spoken to other people, they said they used tea.
There were sports one time, no, very near where I lived. And we were all at sports. And the prizes were penny packages and these kind of things. So Div, Eddie, we used to call him, was in the sports. And he won every one of the prizes. My father was taking a walk down. He used to go down to an old man that was in Stair Park. And he went into Bess Cole, that was her. Bess, we used to call her.
Dave's grandmother.
And grandmother. And he was chilling up for a great little boy, Eddie was. And all the penny packages and that kind of prizes were, you know. And he won all the races and jumping.
Mrs. Nora Joyce remembering the virile and happy youth of our boy from Broree. Indeed, he was always that, a boy from Knockmore, a man from Broree, a man from County Limerick, a countryman. And as we sat there in those glorious winter mornings in the mid-60s, when he was into his 80s, it was not so difficult to imagine all of that, because when he looked back, one saw the whole path of history unfold before one. It was as if one touched the pith of the life of this nation for a short while. Always, as I say, his thoughts came back to Broree, the long, long thoughts of boyhood, the why and the wherefore, the reasons for, and the reasons, I suppose, why his life turned out as it did. There was one extraordinary factor, of course, in all of these recordings, in that President De Valera, was blind at the time. So all came from his mind, his memory, and as he looked back, he was looking back with his heart, back again, like I say, and repeated over and over again to these days in Broree. It was an extraordinary tour de force. It had its very amusing moments, like a day when a microphone bumped and the president said, "You must have kicked the table." I never said anything. It had, of course, poignant moments as well, like when we drew towards the end of the series, and he was genuinely sad, I thought, that the recollections were coming to an end. Genuinely sad, but happy that even then, some 83 years onwards, he could still, in his heart, in his mind, in his soul, in his spirit, see Broree.
I used to often wish that I had my sight so that I might wander along the brook again from Drumcomer right up to Trinity Well, to where it starts in Drummond, and see some of the bushes that I thought would still be growing there, and look into the water and see what fish and what minnow and so on were there, and what birds would be nesting along in the bushes. But of course, I can't do that. Now, one of my regrets, of course, is that I can't see the whole countryside. I can imagine myself on the top of Knockduff, for instance, over the village, on the way to Rock Hill, looking down north towards Tory Hill, and then looking east towards Kilmarnock and west towards the mountains of West Limerick on towards Kerry, and then the Ballyhoura Hills to the south, seeing the whole countryside around.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.